Okay, chapter 5, The Greatest Disappointment. As the Blumenthals approached the West Fork Railroad Station, they began to have feelings of uneasiness. They had heard that exchange Jews going to sell would not be riding in cattle cars. And it was true that there were many third-class carriages attached to the train. These carriages had rows of bench seats inside and windows instead of horizontal wooden slats through which to look out. But the transport was huge. Nearly 1,000 people stood ready to board the 20 or more cars that waited alongside the platform. As always, the uniformed camp police, the camp commandant, and his officers were on the platform, closely monitoring the operation. And once inside the carriages, the Blumenthals and their fellow travelers were packed as tightly as in any cattle car. Okay, where were they headed?
To the...
Who are they being exchanged with? With the German, yes, with the German prisoners. So they had been told that their ships, their ticket for the ship wasn't good until another couple months. But what happened in Rotterdam before that? How did the Nazis make it impossible for them to sail to America?
They had people by
the... They made them change their middle name.
That was earlier. What happened in the city of Rotterdam? Actually, what happened over most of Europe before that?
People were controlling it.
Who was controlling it?
The Nazis.
The Nazis, yes. The Nazis took control of Poland. The Nazis took control of the city of Rotterdam, and they blew up the port so that they couldn't ship out people and ship in people. And the Dutch cities, the Dutch didn't want to fight. They didn't want to be involved in the war, so they just gave up peacefully and let the Germans have control of their town. So the Blumenthals figured out the only way they could get out was to put their name on a list to be exchanged with Nazi prisoners. And Germany would exchange, they would say, okay, you can have 10 Jewish people if you give us 10 Nazi prisoners. So they were exchanging war prisoners for Jewish people. Okay, with a blast of the whistle, train at last announced its departure. At the camp boundary, it stopped once again for a final count of the passengers by the German occupation forces. The total had to be the exact same as vouched for by the West Fork camp commandant. Then, with additional military officers on board to accompany the travelers, the train headed east toward Germany. The camp to which the Blumenthals were going lay a short distance northwest of Celle, near the small town of Bergen and the village of Belsen, so it had been named Bergen-Belsen. The journey took about 5 hours. Although Marion had no idea of its length, she vividly remembered her arrival at the camp itself. It was dark, bitterly cold, and raining, Marion recalled. All I could see as I stepped down onto the ground were the tall, shiny black boots of the SS officers and their dogs, huge, restless, and mean-looking. I was 9 years old and small for my age. The jaws and fanged teeth of the barking and leaping police dogs were exactly at my eye level. Albert stayed close to me, protective as always, but I cringed. I was very frightened. Originally, Bergen-Belsen was intended as a prisoner of war camp, but by early 1944, additional sections had been built. They included a camp for Jews with passports from neutral countries such as Spain, Portugal, and Turkey, a camp for Polish Jews, most of whom would soon be transported to Auschwitz and murdered there, and a camp for exchange Jews like the Blumenthals. This section was known as Sternlager, the Star Camp. Star probably referred to the prisoners wearing of the yellow star rather than to any star or special status. For although the prisoners were allowed to wear their own clothing and the male and female family members could meet briefly during the day, the barracks were crude, dark, and crowded, and the SS and their assistants were harsh and bullying. Even the very worst conditions at West Fork, Ruth said, were a heaven by comparison, for Bergen-Belsen was hell. The only way we managed to survive in those early months of 1944, cold, hungry, and completely degraded, was on hope. We were waiting for the Ostasch, the exchange of Jews for German prisoners of war. That would take us to Palestine. In May 1944, 3 months after the Blumenthal's arrival at Bergen-Belsen, the names of the Jews scheduled for exchange were at last announced. We stood, Ruth recalled, in the Sternlager Square, listening carefully as the commanding officer began to read off the list. It was arranged alphabetically, starting, of course, with the A's. When he began to read the B's, we held our breaths tightly. Before we knew it, however, he had gone to the C's and D's. There was no Blumenthal. Still knowing we must keep order, we continued to listen. Perhaps there would be names out of place. Perhaps there would be a few more names after the Z's. Perhaps there would even be a second list. With sinking hearts, we heard the names called. No, there was no Blumenthal. I could tell that Walter was going to speak up, to speak to the officer in charge. He left his place, approached him respectfully, and saluted as in his army days. Then he asked him politely if our name might have been skipped over. No, the answer came back. Your name is not on the list. Walter held out the certificate from the International Red Cross. But all our papers are in order, he pleaded. Can't you look into this? Already, Walter had gone too far. The officer lost his patience. Without warning, he struck Walter sharply across the neck and back. Saw Jude, or Pig Jew, the officer shrieked. Go back to your place. In that moment, all hope died for the Blumenthals. There had been so many disappointments, the failed escape from Germany, the canceled sailing of the New Amsterdam, the horror of being transferred to the concentration camp of Bergen-Belsen. But this, Ruth said, this refusal to honor the Palestine certificate was the greatest disappointment of all. At a much later date, the family learned that of a group of 1,100 Jews who had been sent to Bergen-Belsen for the promised exchange, only 221 ever reached Palestine. The Jews who were chosen left the camp quietly at the end of June 1944, traveled by train to Istanbul, and safely reached Haifa by the ship on June 10th. For those who remained behind, no further appeals to the Red Cross or to the Bergen-Belsen camp administration had the slightest effort. We went on, Marion said, with our aimless existence. It was now more important than ever for me to search over and over again for my four perfect pebbles. Why is she looking for her pebbles? What do they mean to her? If she finds four pebbles, what does it mean?
That means that she's, that they're gonna, like, get out of it.
Yeah, it means that if she can find four pebbles that match perfectly, that means she thinks that the family's going to get out of it okay. I knew even then that in spite of everything, our family must survive. Mama was lucky to keep her job in the kitchen. The women in camp begged to work there because of the chance to get extra food. Often they mobbed the soldiers who held them back. The rest of the time, these women spent hours talking about food and exchanging recipes. Papa had brought cigarettes with him from Westbork to trade for extra rations of bread. When those were gone, he saved the ones that were given to the male prisoners at Bergen-Belsen from time to time. But after some months passed, no more were given out. So he had saved bread from his own ration. I remember our birthday presents to one another. They were a portion of our week's ration of bread. How many of you would like to get bread for a birthday present? How many of you, if you were starving, would like to get? Yes, absolutely. One day of Appell, at Appell, a young German guard gave my brother an apple. He must have endangered his own life in doing so. Despite the craving for the crunchy, juicy apple, Albert did not keep it for himself. He divided it into an untold number of pieces. This act of kindness by a German soldier was like a flicker of light in the darkness and made our bleak existence more bearable, at least for the moment. One of the most frightening ordeals at Bergen-Belsen was being taken once a month to the showers. Why would being taken to the showers be frightening?
Because the acid?
Because the gas.
Okay, that was at Auschwitz, right. They knew that people died in shower-like gas chambers at Auschwitz. So they didn't know, are we going for a shower or are we actually going to be killed? By now, the summer of 1944, the gas chambers at Auschwitz had been operating for 2.5 years. Rumors had long been circulated that a death camp gas chamber looked almost exactly like an ordinary public shower room. Even though we had been told, Marion said, that there were no gas chambers at Bergen-Belsen, how could we ever be sure? We were marched to a special building, just as in Auschwitz, and were made to undress in the presence of the male guards. We folded our clothes neatly, tied our shoes together, and left them outside. Then we were given a piece of soap and pushed inside. The door was slammed shut, and we waited, terrified, to see if water would come out of the overhead nozzles, or, as at Auschwitz, the killing fumes of the gas known as Zyklon B. The soap that the prisoners at Bergen-Belsen were given before entering the showers did not guarantee their harmlessness, for it was a common practice at Auschwitz to provide soap and also the promise of hot coffee or warm soup afterward in order to maintain calm and to deceive those about to be gassed. The deadly poison the Germans had chosen to use at Auschwitz and other human extermination centers was originally designed for insect and rodent control. Its purpose was to fumigate ships and warehouses and to disinfect clothing. Zyklon B, which looked in its solid form like innocent blue crystals, was packed in airtight canisters, then released into the air through the shower-like nozzles of a gas chamber. It turned into vapor that brought death within 15 minutes. After the gas had dissipated, the Auschwitz camp attendants, who were usually prisoners themselves, salvaged the gold from the teeth of the dead, pulled rings from their fingers, and cut off the women's hair. This booty, along with the clothing of the newly dead and the contents of their suitcases, was sent back to Germany, where it had many uses. The corpses of the gassed prisoners were then burned to ash in the Auschwitz ovens. Bergen-Belsen, too, had a crematorium. Its high square chimney was similar in appearance to that of Auschwitz, but its chief use was to burn the bodies of those who had died of natural causes, starvation, exhaustion, disease. Later, as the camp filled beyond its capacity, the crematorium could no longer keep up with the body count. The dead at Bergen-Belsen were then burned in open pits, tossed into mass graves, or even strewn about above ground. The stench of burning flesh from those open pits, Marion said, remains in my nostrils to this day. It was even worse than the foul odors of disease, decay, and the lack of sanitation that drew in with every breath. Slowly, starting with the Allies' D-Day invasion of France in June 1944, the war began to turn against the Germans. At the same time, the Russians were gradually closing in from the east. But at Bergen-Belsen in the autumn of 1944, the worst was yet to come. To hide the evidence of Auschwitz and the other camps in Poland, the SS began to drive prisoners back into the interior of Germany. Bergen-Belsen was to receive an especially large influx. In the Sternlager, additional wooden barracks were being built. They were not ready in time for the transport of more than 3,600 women from the Auschwitz-Birkenau. In the cold and wet autumn, the women were crammed into a tent city with a latrine dug in the mud. For the Blumenthals and their fellow prisoners, the winter of 1944 through 1945 proved the most difficult yet. Food had become extremely scarce, and there was no longer enough water for bathing, washing clothes, or even drinking. The cold was intense. So now they're in a camp. What are they without now because there's so many prisoners?
Food.
They don't have food.
Water.
They don't have water to wash, to drink. Their clothes are dirty. And there's no way. There are people in the winter living in tents. Now, do you think they're given winter coats and blankets? No. Many of them probably died. As I had learned to do the winter before, Marion explained, I followed the advice of the older women to prevent frostbite in my fingers and toes. After standing at roll call, sometimes for hours, we would return to the barracks and warm our extremities with our own urine. So how are they warming their feet?
Peeing on their feet.
Peeing on their own feet to warm them. Now, one of my main occupations was to pick the lice from my clothing one by one and destroy them with my fingernails. Our bodies, our hair, our blankets, all were infested. for the barracks themselves were crawling with lice because of the overcrowded and unclean conditions. Hair lice laid their eggs, called nits, in our hair. Clothing lice preferred the seams of our garments and our bedding. I remember one garment I loved and tried to preserve. It was an off-white, hand-knitted wool cardigan with short sleeves that someone had made for me in Westborg. Somehow it stretched to fit me as I grew. I still wore it in Bergen-Belsen, for there my body weight was actually decreasing because of the growing hunger. By the early months of 1945, food at Bergen-Belsen consisted mainly of cabbage-flavored water and moldy bread. This ration was far less than the 600 calories a day per inmate that the camp had formerly provided. The prisoners found themselves longing for turnip soup with bits of gristly horse meat and the pats of yellow grease called butter that they had received in the better days. Despite the total breakdown in the food supply and the sanitary conditions, the SS continued to concentrate on preventing escape. Daily roll calls went on for hours in the numbing cold. Police dogs, so dangerous that their handlers had to wear thick arm guards and carry dog whips and pistols, continued to terrify the shivering inmates standing at Appell. The death toll was now mounting rapidly as a result of exposure, hunger, severe diarrhea, and fevers. In addition, as the winter drew to an end, the lice-borne disease known as typhus began to spread throughout the camp. The symptoms were high fever, a red rash, headache, delirium, often resulting in death. By March 1945, 35,000 out of 60,000 prisoners at Bergen-Belsen had died, mainly of typhus. Yes, Marion said, death had become a moment-to-moment occurrence. In our dark, crowded quarters, we often tripped and fell over the newly dead. Their bodies could not be taken away quickly enough. Yet even with the terrible sights all around us, even with the stench of overflowing latrines in our nostrils, those of us who could still function yearned above all for food. Bread came first among our longings, which we called the three B's, bread, bath, bed and bath. For food was survival. One evening in early April 1945, Mama, who still worked in the kitchen, was able to smuggle some potatoes, turnips, and salt into our barrack. She also brought an empty can, and with some splintered wood from our bed slats, she managed to build a small fire over which to cook a soup. We had carefully chosen a place on the uppermost bed of a triple-decker bunk where we and some others could shield our illegal and dangerous activity. The soup took a long time to cook. It was still bubbling away and was almost done when Mama and I heard the sound of the guards approaching for a surprise visit. I was sitting on the bed near the pot of soup with my right leg bent at the knee. In our haste to cover up what we were doing, we tipped over the pot and the boiling soup spilled across my leg, scalding the lower part from the knee down. I was just a few months past my 10th birthday, but I did not utter a sound. I knew better than to cry out. In the 14 months in Bergen-Belsen, the Nazis had tried to break us physically, spiritually, and emotionally. They forced us to learn self-discipline the hard way. Perhaps it was good that I had been stubborn and strong-willed. Mama and I lost the soup that evening, but not our lives. Medical treatment of any kind had long ceased to be available in the camp, which was now in a state of almost complete turmoil. The war, it was rumored, would be over soon, and the bombers roared overhead even during the daylight hours, while at night the rumbling of the Allied artillery could be heard shelling the Western Front German cities. Would the camp commandant Joseph Kramer, the notorious Beast of Belsen, surrender the camp peacefully, or would he order his SS to attempt a last stand, resulting in mass murder? So they're asking the question, if this camp is taken over, what are the two choices? Is he going to surrender peacefully, or what would happen to all the prisoners if he doesn't surrender peacefully? What does he think? What does Marion think might happen? Yeah. I mean, it's the Nazis do not care for the Jews. They could very likely, once the people come into the camp, choose to shoot every remaining prisoner. And would the prisoners have enough strength to put up a fight? No. For some 8,000 prisoners, the Blumenthals among them, the outcome would remain in question. Within days of the boiling soup accident that had severely burned Marion's leg, the members of the family learned that they were to be evacuated to the east. What does it mean if they're being evacuated to the east? What camp are they going to?
Move it out.
Where? What camp are they going to go to? Why is it bad to be moved to the east?
Because it's...
What happens at the camp in the east? You get killed. Auschwitz is the camp in the east. If you go to Auschwitz, where do they automatically take you?
Gas chambers.
The gas chambers, yeah. On April 9th, 1945, Marion said, "We were marched to the station and put aboard a long train of cattle cars. My leg was now infected and oozing a thick yellow pus. The pain was very great and I could not walk. We did not know that Auschwitz had been liberated by the Russians in January 1945, and we were sure that that was where the Germans were sending us. It made no sense for them to ship us east when other prisoners were being evacuated west. But that was how it appeared, and we were given no explanation of anything. Once more, this time was so close to the war's end, it seemed that our chances of survival were being snatched away from us and that death loomed closer than ever. 6 days later, on April 15, 1945, British troops reached Bergen-Belsen and liberated the camp. The commandant, Joseph Kramer, gave it up without a struggle. He was later tried by a British military court and hanged. The thousands of prisoners who were still alive were freed and cared for, but the Blumenthals were not among them." And that is the end of chapter 5.